Today, it's truly a great pleasure to have Professor Paul Langenkirk from the Institute for Advanced Study. Paul got his PhD from Berkeley in 1972. He spent much of his career in the University of Pennsylvania. Paul recently visited Stockholm, where he was invited guest by the Nobel Committee to participate in the Nobel festivities for the Higgs boson discovery. As most of you know, probably the Higgs boson was the last unverified piece of the star model. And this is particularly fitting because Paul's career has more or less paralleled the development of the star model. And Paul has contributed greatly to the establishment of the star model as our most precise understanding of the subatomic world. Paul's contributions are vast and numerous to mention in one introduction. He has something of the order of 50,000 citations, I think, to the work.
No, that's a big data group.
But still, it's an impressive number. It's not for nothing that Paul had already contributions to discovering a sign error in the solar neutrino problem. He has contributed to neutrino physics. He's a pioneer in the tests for electroweak precision test of electric precision data, and that's our most precise understanding of the star model at high energies. Paul is the granddaddy of Z prime models, and most recently has done a lot of work on string phenomenology, and many more things. And today, I think many of those ingredients will appear in his talk. So let's hear him out.
Thank you very much.
First, I'm very happy to be here. This is only the second time I've been to Perimeter. The first time was for a conference about 9 years ago. I keep forgetting each morning for the PSI lectures to do this until I get Howard at.
Okay, this standard model seems to be very successful, but I'm going to be talking about what's beyond the standard model, and I'm going to take a rather perhaps atypical or slightly heretical viewpoint. I'm going to be talking about some general issues from a superstring-inspired perspective. And so you'll be hearing a bottom-up phenomenological physicist talking from a top-down superstring-inspired perspective. And I will especially be addressing some issues such as uniqueness and minimality and other things. First of all, the standard model is spectacularly successful, and it's spectacularly unsuccessful. It's a mathematically consistent theory. Is there a laser pointer here somewhere?
I guess we have a hockey stick.
Oh, the hockey stick? Okay. That'll do. Fend off any hostile questions. It's a mathematically consistent renormalizable field theory, which certainly has, to an excellent approximation, describes nature under normal conditions down to a thousandth of the size of the atomic nucleus. And recently, the Higgs boson, or something that's very similar to it, has been discovered as the sort of final piece. However, the standard model is very complicated. It's very has a lot of sort of arbitrary sounding ingredients, and it involves a number of severe fine tunings. And it also does not actually explain the dark matter or dark energy. So most effort in particle physics is in one way or another beyond the standard model. And probably the most popular approach is, or was until recently at least, supersymmetry. And in particular, the simplest version of supersymmetry, the minimal supersymmetric extension of the standard model. That's the one in which every standard model particle has a partner with differing in spin by 1/2 unit, and in which one has to actually have two Higgs doublets instead of one because of the supersymmetry. Now, What I mean by the standard paradigm is the view that many, not all, but many physicists held until recently, and some still hold, namely that there is some MSSM, a minimal supersymmetry, broken at the TEV scale. Now, we have not seen any sign of supersymmetry yet at the LHC, and that's why I say that not everybody is so convinced as they used to be. And the standard paradigm generally involved the idea of the lightest supersymmetric partner playing the role of a weakly interacting massive particle to be dark matter. Still no idea what the dark energy is, perhaps some miraculously small cosmological constant. Usually it's assumed that there's some grand unified theory in which the strengths of the three interactions merge and they all become part of one big simple group, such as SU5, at a very large energy scale. And that's gauge unification suggested by the observed gauge couplings and their runnings. Usually it's assumed that the small neutrino masses are Majorana, generated by, that is lepton number violating, generated by a seesaw model in which there's a very heavy right-handed neutrino and the small mass is inversely proportional to this large mass scale that's a little bit below the gut scale. And the seesaw model has a nice feature that it has a mechanism in it to explain the baryon asymmetry of the universe. And a lot of the work also assumes, combines the idea with grand unification in order to at least attempt to start classifying the spectrum and mixings of the neutrinos as well as the other fundamental particles. And usually one has to introduce extra flavor symmetries into the game, and many of the models in the grand unified theory viewpoint involve very large representations for scalars, such as 126-dimensional. It is, I won't get into the supersymmetry breaking, but it's an implicit assumption in almost all of this work, not only in the supersymmetry, but other beyond the standard model, that there are ideas such as naturalness, uniqueness, and minimality. And I will have some comments on those things. Okay, still sticking with supersymmetry, I have argued for a long time that even if there is supersymmetry at the TEV scale, the MSSM need not be the theory. It could very well be a more complicated theory. Most beyond the standard model assumes either MSSM supersymmetry and that's it, or other stuff without supersymmetry. But it could well be that there's other stuff plus supersymmetry. And the MSSM actually does not solve all the standard model problems, and it introduces new ones, such as electric dipole moments and Faber changing effects. It introduces the so-called mu problem, that is the mass of the partner of the Higgs boson cannot be too large, but that's actually a supersymmetric mass, and why it should be at the TEV scale related to same scale as supersymmetry breaking is a mystery. When one attempts to build larger theories, grand unified theories, string theories, it is often the case that you don't just get the MSSM. Many, or I'd say most superstring constructions that try to derive something that looks like the supersymmetric standard model actually find what I call remnants that survive to low energy, such as larger gauge groups, exotic fermions and their partners, extended Higgs sectors. And most of the people who work in this field consider these remnants to be a defect of the constructions and don't even consider them. I actually think it may be a hint of what's likely to be beyond the standard model. That is, these remnants, which I define a remnant as something that is there at low energies just due to the accidents of how the underlying physics worked and not because it solved some problem of the low energy theory. I will say that some of the ingredients of the standard paradigm, such as four-dimensional grand unified theories, large Higgs representations, are very hard to embed in superstring constructions. So I feel it's important to explore extensions or alternatives to that viewpoint. Okay, let me make some general comments now. First on naturalness versus tuning. And my remarks here are not unique. Lots of people have been making similar comments for the last year or so. Atlas and CMS have not observed any sign of supersymmetry or any of the other new types of physics that people have postulated to underlie the standard model. But they have discovered the Higgs particle or the Higgs-like particle, which is certainly consistent with the elementary Higgs. Now the mass, 125 or 126, is probably the strangest mass you can imagine, because in the standard model, without supersymmetry, the Higgs mass is not predicted, but there are consistent theoretical constraints that give a lower limit of about 125, right where it is. Namely, if the Higgs were any lighter, the vacuum would be unstable and the universe would just disintegrate. And for the observed Higgs mass, and it depends on the top mass, where what's observed actually lies right on the borderline where the vacuum is metastable, can live for more than 10 to the 14 years, but it's very funny. One expected a standard model Higgs to be heavier. That constraint disappears in the supersymmetric extension because other particles cure that stability problem. However, the Higgs mass is not completely arbitrary. It's related to gauge masses. And it's very hard, if the supersymmetry breaking scale is a TeV, it's very hard to get the mass as high as that. So it was expected to be a little bit lower. So it's right in the cutoff region. It had been expected before that if the Higgs were discovered, it would tell us whether there was supersymmetry or not. It's just on the borderline. Now, of course, everybody knows that in the field knows that the mass square of the Higgs in the standard model is highly unnatural. That is, one would expect if there's no new physics above the TeV scale that loop corrections to the Higgs mass squared should, which are quadratically divergent, should promote the Higgs mass squared up to the next energy scale, which might be the Planck scale. So in other words, unless you fine-tune things by 34 decimal places, it's hard to understand without some underlying new physics why the Higgs mass is where it is. And this was the major motivation not only for supersymmetry at the TeV scale, but alternative electroweak symmetry breaking schemes without an elementary Higgs and large dimensions. All of these in one way or another could cure that problem. However, we haven't seen signs of any of these. Is naturalness really a good guide? Well, most physicists think so, but it's being stressed a little bit by the combination of the mass and the lack of other new physics. For example, and maybe it's not a good guide, the dark energy, if viewed as a cosmological constant, has to be fine-tuned by about 120 orders of magnitude. Compared to what one would naively expect in, from vacuum energy associated with the largest scale of the theory, the Planck scale. And nobody's, to my knowledge, has a very compelling solution to that one, except perhaps the environmental solution, which is Weinberg's idea that if the cosmological constant were very much bigger than what we see, either the universe would have expanded so fast that no structure, no galaxies or stars could have formed, or collapsed so fast that we'd be gone in an instant. And that's called the environmental solution. Only if it has the value it has could we be here to see it. That's, I'm going to come back to that. Even if there is still, pardon me. Yeah, I said. Okay, I accept your statement on that.
No, another point is that if you increase lambda, you can just correspondingly increase the density fluctuations and still have galaxies and so forth. So Weinberg's argument is actually not very predictive when you consider not just lambda, but the density fluctuations of other parameters.
I defer to both of your comments. So. However, I wanted to just make the final statement that even if it turns out that there is new supersymmetry or other such things that's sort of right around the corner, one still has a little bit of a hierarchy problem. Maybe not 34 orders of magnitude, but nevertheless some fine tuning. However, some of the other problems of supersymmetry are actually would be made less of a problem. Okay, let me turn to uniqueness versus environment, which is, I'm sure, probably the most controversial aspect of what I want to say. There is gauge theories for the, which we know describe the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions, are wonderfully constraining because they leave very little arbitrariness. Well, actually, there is a lot of arbitrariness. You have to pick the gauge group and the representations of matter and whether there's spontaneous breaking. But once you've chosen those things, then a given simple gauge factor has only one parameter, the gauge coupling in it. So that's wonderfully constraining. But in the standard model, one has, in addition to the gauge interactions, the Yukawa couplings of the Higgs fields to the different fermions, and those are the things that determine the masses and mixings of the fermions and go under the name of Flaber physics. And those are largely, well, seem, at least in the standard model context, to be unconstrained. And so one coupling's of order 1 to give the top quark mass, another coupling's of order 10 to the minus 6 to give the electron its mass. In the most naive model of neutrino masses, you would have, without the seesaw, you'd have others to be 10 to the minus 12. And so it seems to be very chaotic. And it is within the context of the standard model, although, and so many physicists have said, well, let's go beyond the standard model and try to find new symmetries or new principles to control these things. The uniqueness paradigm, which is sort of implicitly assumed by most physicists, is that there must be some underlying simple, unique underlying theory. And especially in physicists who work on Flaber have taken it very much an enormous effort, especially for neutrino sector, to try to identify some extra symmetries that might be gauge symmetries, might be global symmetries, might be discrete symmetries, might be broken in various ways. Some set of symmetries to try to put some reason or some order into the pattern of fermion masses and mixings that we observe. And as I say, there's probably been thousands and thousands of papers along that line in that I can read in the time I can remember. And many of these are in the context of the seesaw. Some of them are in the context of grand unification, plus Flaber symmetries, et cetera. And this is an enormous effort. Many of the models predicted that one of the mixing angles in the neutrino sector, I'm not going to define these, but the neutrino oscillations depend on several mixing angles. And it was thought until a couple of years ago that one of them was consistent with zero and another was consistent with 45 degrees. And those are sort of special numbers. And a lot of these models were very proud to get zero and 45 degrees. In the last couple of years, experimenters have told us that the small one is not zero and the big one's not 45 degrees. And so many of the models were had to be made more complicated or excluded. But at any rate, this was a major effort. It is a major effort, and it may be right. I'm not trying to say that this is wrong, but that's the uniqueness paradigm. But now let's consider the other paradigm. Kepler spent a lot of his career trying to understand, by some unique, elegant mathematical principle, the orbit, the radii of the planets, the orbital radii of the known planets. And he had a beautiful theory based on embedding platonic solids inside of each other, and which sort of matched up with the observed radii at the time. Now, I think most people today would agree that that was the wrong paradigm, that the radii of the orbits are not due to some principle like that, but are rather an accident, let's say an accident of the initial conditions of that part of the formation of that initial, that particular solar system. So the environmental paradigm, which is matched like that, is that perhaps there is no simple, elegant, unique underlying explanation for all of those parameters. Perhaps they are some accident of the conditions of the where we happen to be living, or just like the planetary orbits. And this, I'm not saying that everything is of that form. It could be that there's sort of some different scales for the different families of fermions. I suspect that's not random. It's probably is some different powers of the breaking of some symmetry or something like that. But at any rate, this idea finds a fairly natural home in superstring theory. In string theory, which once was sort of naively hoped to be a unique theory, actually is anything but unique. There seem to be, nobody knows for sure, but there seem to be an enormous number of possible vacua of the string theory, and some estimates have been 10 to the 600 or more. And we have no known selection principle as to which one nature should choose. So it could well be that some of these parameters are just accidents of which of those vacua our world happens to be in. Now, there's some of these vacua are habitable. That is, some of them have conditions that might be conducive to making stars or people or whatever you consider relevant, and some of them are not. Some have different gauge groups, some have different remnants, some have different mechanisms for hierarchies, some have different parameters. Now, another ingredient is that there is some possibility that these different vacua might actually coexist, or that there might different parts of a much larger universe known as the multiverse might actually involve different domains in different vacua. And there are some ideas in inflationary cosmology that suggest that there may be some, these different domains might be pop out of the vacuum all the time by some constant reproducing new universes in many big bangs and many inflations. And so from this point of view, if one postulates that maybe string theory might be correct and that there really are a lot of vacua, and if one postulates that perhaps those ideas of an eternal inflation, which could just sample them all by producing all over the place, producing different vacua, and some of them will be more suitable for life than others, but it's a possibility that this is what's going on. And this allows for the possibility of environmental selection. Some universes might be conducive to life, others not. This is a concrete realization of the anthropic principle. But I'll get to you, just give me a second. Let me finish this statement. The anthropic principle, which I used to think was absolute nonsense, is that laws of physics are the way they are because we couldn't be here to observe them otherwise. But these sets of ideas would give a possible implementation of that. Yes?
The idea of the environmental hypothesis with regard to solar systems is testable. You know very well what I'm going to say, because we have observed other solar systems and we see that there are randomly distributed or widely distributed. Can you name one falsifiable prediction that this alleged paradigm makes?
You can find relationship between parameters within your given realization of the universe that are a prediction. You don't necessarily have to see the other universes to have predictions on the underlying parameters.
No. But the word paradigm, means something for philosophers of science. And one of them, it means that there are testable and falsifiable theories underlying paradigms.
But that's what I just gave you. I gave an example of a falsifiable prediction of the landscape that you can test within your realization of the universe.
Sorry, what's the prediction?
That you could find relationship between parameters that otherwise have no reason to have any.
What's an example of a predicted relationship?
Well, for example, the Higgs mass versus the gauge coupling constants.
So if there were such a relation, it would be, you claim it would be true in every possible vacuum, and therefore would be true.
Right, if you understand the theory that actually populates.
But let's look at the logic of this. If there is such a relation, which is true in every possible universe,
right,
it's consistent with the hypothesis that there's just one universe. So it's not a test of the hypothesis.
Then it's a question of the details of whether, we should let Paul learn.
Yeah. Okay, let me go on, because I was going to say next that probably the vast majority of theoretical physicists are absolutely appalled by this sort of idea for exactly the reasons that you just said. First of all, it's not directly testable. It goes against the traditional definitions of the scientific method. And finally, it was expressed very clearly by one Nobel Prize laureate who rejected all these ideas on the grounds of, quote, "I hate it," unquote. And those are all valid objections to this. However, what I would counter is that it may be true. It could well be true that there is a multiverse sampled by something like an eternal inflation, and that some of them are habitable, some are not, and we happen to live in one. It could be true, and that's independent of whether I can prove it or test it. And so I think I don't agree with the idea that one should just belittle the idea or say, you shouldn't talk about it. I've heard people say it's a no-no to talk about these things just because it goes against traditional scientific paradigm. It could well be true. Now, to try to give my answer, I don't have a good answer to how I would falsify this. I don't think I could really falsify it. However, one could at least go some distance if one could make theoretical progress in the two areas of string theory and multiverse and inflation, utilizing other observations, we might be able eventually, some combination of theory and experiment, convince ourselves that, for example, string theory is wrong, or there is not all these vacua, or conversely, some of the things I'm going to turn to, that I'm not going to continue on this for the rest of the talk, but some of the things I'm going to talk about could conceivably give us a little more confidence in 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 years that the basic framework of the string theory is right, and perhaps on the other aspect of the inflation. So it's not necessary to be able to verify every aspect of a theory, but if one could convince ourselves, and I don't expect this to happen next week, but we might be able in 20 or 50 or 100 years to pretty much convince ourselves that these two ideas of the inflation, internal inflation and the string landscape are either true or false. And then I could imagine that we would have enough confidence in the theories that one could
give a fairly convincing demonstration or refutation of some of these ideas. That's the best I can do. I would love to be able to give you a compelling answer that this telescope will give me some way of solving the problem. I can't, but what I keep coming back to is it could be true, and I think we should seriously discuss it and think about it. Yes?
As Aaron Guth says, in eternal inflation, anything can happen. If anything can happen, you can never prove or disprove it.
There are some things that I think are, let me go on because I'll start to slightly address this. I'm not going to satisfy any of you, but I nevertheless believe that string theory is actually more confining than field theory, for example. And there's a lot of things that can happen in field theory that are probably unlikely to occur in the string landscape. And I'd like to mention some of those aspects. Yes, sir.
Let me just leave this, because we could argue about this all day with the clarity of. If somebody could propose an explanation for the fine-tunings of the standard model that did give falsifiable predictions, would you agree that that would be superior to investigating this environmental paradigm?
I would personally find that more satisfactory, especially if I could really verify the aspects of it theoretically, experimentally.
Good.
But I personally am not disturbed by this. I'm disturbed by the fact that I'm not disturbed at all personally by the picture I've set up of the multiverse and the inflation. To me, that seems perfectly plausible. I am disturbed by the questions you're asking me that I can't prove it or demonstrate it in the traditional scientific way. That bothers me a lot. Yes.
Much as I find it distasteful to defend this idea, one possibility in the future is that a selection principle will be discovered, in which case 10 to the 600 could go back to 1.
Absolutely.
And that would be one way of perhaps making some people happy, but I'm not sure it would make others happy.
That would be a nice falsification of the ingredients of what I said, yes.
Well, I'm not quite sure I'd go as far as falsification, but at least it would be viewed as a stronger theoretical paradox.
On the other hand, it is true that there are these fine tunings, and if we found a selection principle, it would be a sort of marvelous coincidence if the selection principle happened to be the one that gave what looks like fine tunings. But I mean, it could be.
Well, it certainly has to give us, or we wouldn't be talking about it. In that sense, it's got to be at least that anthropic, right?
Yes, correct. Okay, let me continue, because I'm not going to continue on that vein any longer. Except this slide. The first published paper I could find on this idea of the multiverse is from 1603. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Wasn't that paper rejected for publication?
Okay, so, well, I basically said this, and I feel that the if one did have something like this paradigm, it could well be that we live here, you know, in our universe, in one vacuum, and presumably within the one vacuum, one could start from the string theory and say what all the fluxes are, blah, 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 and sort of explain things from the characterization of that one vacuum. But it could well be so incredibly complicated that we would never get at it from the bottom-up point of view of just trying to add discrete symmetries to the neutrino mass matrix. Okay, so I've said most of this already, but I want to just mention that within this landscape of string vacua, as far as we know, many contain the standard model, or the MSSM, but many of them don't. Many of them are clearly not consistent with our world. Many of them involve more than the standard model, or MSSM. And what's very, very typical when people have tried to start with a given string construction,
I don't care if it's heterotic or a type 2 intersecting breed or whatever. People very frequently, when they try to get something that looks like our world, they often find remnants at the TEV scale. And I already mentioned this, but I'll mention it again. And the most common by far are extra U1 gauge symmetries and associated gauge bosons. Exotics, that by that I mean things like new fermions and their super partners that have quantum numbers that are different than the standard model ones. In the standard model, all the left-handed fields are in weak doublets and right-hand fields are weak singlets. Often you'll get exotics in which, say, both left and right are singlets or both left and right are doublets. You often get extended Higgs sectors, such as more than one pair of Higgs doublets in supersymmetry, or Higgs singlets, or that can play various roles. One also gets typically finds quasi-hidden sectors, new sectors of physics that are at most weakly coupled to our own, similar to the ideas that people talk about in some models of dark matter involving a weakly coupled dark sector. That things like that are extremely common in the constructions. Most of the people who work in string phenomenology, when they try to survey a class of string vacua, usually they take the viewpoint that they want to derive the MSSM. So they'll typically have some computer program that searches large numbers of vacua and throws out everyone that has any of these things and only keeps the one out of a million that don't have those sorts of things and then displays them. My viewpoint's different. These things are so common that it may be a hint that one or more of these things might be there at the string scale. And I would say that if we observed something like this, it certainly wouldn't prove string theory. I'm not trying to claim anything like that. But it would be the sort of thing one expects from, in my view, from string theory. Now, these top-down remnants, as I call them, may not be minimal, and they may not be motivated by standard model problems. So a lot of model building from the bottom up invokes minimality. Let's have the minimal extension we can, or let's have solve some standard model problem. This stuff might just be there. It slips through the nets of the compactifications and doesn't solve anything for you. So let me address minimality. I don't know how many people recognize this photograph. This is the Cottrine experiment. It's a tritium beta decay experiment. The spectrometer for it, which will push the sensitivity on the direct kinematic mass of the neutrino, of the electron neutrino, or the relevant linear combination, down to a few tenths of an electron volt. As you can see, it takes a very large spectrometer, and you can see the difficulty they had moving it through the streets of Caro's room to the laboratory. And this was quite a festive occasion, apparently, in Caro's room when this was done a few years ago. Now, where does minimality come in? Well, this was fabricated in a small town near Munich. And Karlsruhe's here, it's about 300 kilometers apart. And so to move it, they took the minimal route would have been here, but the best route is this one. And that's how they transported it. So sometimes the minimal solution is not the best. So some bottom-up ideas are unlikely to emerge from simple perturbative string constructions. By the way, when I talk about a string construction, I'm assuming that our sector is perturbatively connected to the string scale. A string theory could give all kinds of layers of compositeness in between. I've got nothing to say about that. I'm implicitly assuming a perturbative connection. For example, the higher dimensional representations, the 126 dimensional representations of SO10 that are so routinely invoked in neutrino models are unlikely to emerge in any perturbative construction.
I've learned that the institute to never say it could not occur because there may be some non-Calabi-Yau manifold that nobody's ever thought of that would get it somehow. And there's even been some hint that maybe one could make a very complicated F-theory construction. But basically, string theory is like to have bifundamentals and adjoints and so forth and not high-dimensional representation. So I would say if constructions like that work, that would be a strong argument against string theory. Top-down studies may suggest new physical mechanisms. For example, there's been a lot of work by several groups on string instanton effects, which are effective global symmetries of the low-energy theory at the perturbative level that are broken non-perturbatively by instanton effects, deep brain instanton effects, and which get exponentially suppressed masses or Yukawa couplings or other parameters. And that's an alternative to the sort of power law suppressions that one usually invokes for things like mass hierarchies. So I feel it's very important to at least try to map out the types of new physics that are likely to occur in simple perturbative string constructions and which are not. And to contrast this with field theory, which is even more general. And again, this is not what most people do who work in string phenomenology. It's more general. Now, I have three cartoons to illustrate what I mean by this. Suppose we have some manifold of possible physics. And here's the standard model. Here's strong dynamics. Here's supersymmetry. Here's the MSSM. And here's some restricted form, like some minimal supergravity. And most of the bottom-up work invokes minimality, which would look for relatively small perturbations around the standard model and focuses on these. But it could be, and the experience I've had, which is limited but non-zero, is that when one actually tries, either from heterodic side or from type 2 side, to construct things that contain the standard model and or the MSSM, one typically finds a subclass of this manifold that's different from the minimal one. Some of the extensions are minimal, some of them contain the MSSM, some are supersymmetric that go beyond the MSSM. But there's a sort of likely manifold. Now, I wish I could quantitatively map this out in great detail. That's a problem, something I can't do. If there's 10 to the 600, obviously, I'm very limited. And the strong dynamics I've excluded by fiat. I'm just basically talking about things that are perturbatively connected to the string scale in our sector. There could be other strong sectors. Now, when one tries to do this in constructions, certain things keep coming up again and again and again and again. I'm not saying every construction has all of these things or even any of these things, but they come up frequently. As I said, extended gauge groups such as Z primes. Z primes are U1s are tend to slip through. If you start with a non-abelian group and have some breaking mechanism, often a U1 will just sort of slip through. Extended Higgs and neutralino sectors, especially having additional more than two doublets and often singlets, such as ones that are involve one of the solutions to that problem. And obviously, extended Higgs sector means extended neutralino sectors, implications for LHC, implications for dark matter. Quasi-chiral exotics. That means new fermions that are, what I mean by quasi-chiral is that are non-chiral with respect to the standard model gauge group,
And it should be non-chiral with respect to the standard model gauge group, just mainly because you could get chiral also, but there's strong experimental constraints on chiral. A heavy chiral particle involves large Yukawa couplings, which lead to Landau poles at very low energies, et cetera. Yes?
And just to push a personal agenda, another thing would be a large axion sector in a lot of string models.
I didn't put that on the list, but you're right. String models often have enlarged axion sectors, yes. And I should put that on my list. I have another page, but it's not on the other page, too. Thank you. Quasi-chiral means, however, that things that are charged under some extended symmetry. That extended symmetry might be extra U1, or it might be a global symmetry at the perturbative level. You can have global perturbative level symmetries in string theory. You often find leptoquark or diquark type couplings, new particles that can couple to a quark and a lepton, that's called a leptoquark, or two quarks, that's a diquark. R parity violation, family non-universality. Often in constructions, the different families actually have different origins within the original theory and happen by chance, let's say, to have the same standard model quantum numbers, but maybe different under U1s, et cetera. You can have all kinds of neutrino mass mechanisms. You can have by higher dimensional operators, by exponentially suppressed instanton effects. These can be, you can get forms of the seesaw. I've never seen from any serious string construction a real implementation of the usual seesaw model. There have been things that involve large numbers of right-handed neutrinos that don't have any of the SO10 symmetries and which are called seesaw, so you can do that. You can also have Weinberg operators directly, although they tend to get too small a mass. You can have small Dirac masses that are suppressed by some of these other effects. You can have small sterile neutrino masses if that's actually called for by LS&D mini-boon. As I said, you often have the quasi-hidden sectors or truly hidden sectors that may be only very weakly coupled to our own, if at all. Very, very common. There may be perturbative global symmetries. Often you have UN gauge groups rather than SUNs, and the extra U1s in these cases are sometimes anomalous. The gauge boson acquires a large mass, but the U1 symmetry survives as a global symmetry on the low energy theory at the perturbative level, broken by exponentially suppressed terms. You often find non-standard hypercharge embeddings or normalizations that can modify the gauge unification conditions, either mess up gauge unification or push the scale up to a string scale or various possibilities. You often find fractionally charged color singlet states with charge a half or other strange things. Those would be terrible, are incredibly strong experimental limits if they're low energy. But if they're very high mass, or if they're confined, like quarks are confined, they would be a possibility. And there's possibility of large or warped extra dimensions if there's a very low string scale. One could imagine even time or space or environment varying couplings. There's been a lot of phenomenological thoughts about that. The limits are pretty strong, though, on it. And you could even have things like Lorentz invariance violation or violation of the equivalence principle. And often, lots of axions. So those are the typical types of things that people see. So I would argue that although I cannot not imagine proving or disproving string theory this way, I would be very interested 10 years from now if we observe new physics it'd be nice to know whether it fell into this class that comes up again and again in constructions or whether it doesn't. And that would neither definitively prove or disprove string theory, but I think it would be very helpful. Yes?
Given, if I buy the logic, which I don't, but if I buy the logic of the anthropic principle of the environmentally selected, blah, 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 many of the things on your list do not disturb the habitability of the universe. So can you make a generic statement like, if the string landscape is true, then something of this must be seen in the next 10 years?
No, I can't make a generic statement like that. And don't overdo my statements about anthropic. I said that's a possibility one should keep in mind seriously that might be relevant to some of the fine-tuning. I'm not trying to claim that everything's determined anthropically.
Right, no. But just to follow the logic, if I accept your proposal, there's a large landscape, and that our universe is environmentally selected from it, and that almost everything in the landscape compatible with the standard model also has some other exotic stuff, and no other exotic stuff is seen, doesn't that count as evidence against your hypothesis?
I think I said that. I think I said that if either none of this is seen or other stuff that's very different is seen, that would be definitely an argument against my hypothesis.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I should try to emphasize one more time. I understand all the difficulties and philosophical objections to string theory and to anthropic principle and the multiverse and landscape, and it's not directly testable, etc. I understand that, and I wish I could have an answer, but I keep coming back to the statement, it might be true, so in my own little humble way, I've just tried to do the little tiny bit I can to think in that direction, and the little bit I can is to say, well, at least in the types of string constructions I've seen, this is the type of stuff you usually get. That's all I can do. I wish I could do more.
But I think you're doing something very powerful.
Yeah.
Because if almost everything compatible with the standard model, compatible with life in the landscape also has exotics,
mm-hmm.
and exotics are not seen, then that is a quite strong piece of evidence
for
the hypothesis.
There have been constructions that don't have many of these things. I haven't seen a really realistic construction that has absolutely none of these, but not every construction has these things. As I say, people usually will search over thousands of models and then display the one that doesn't have much of this stuff. But there may be ones that don't have any of it. But I would say it's an argument against.
But if the only selection is anthropic, that's irrelevant. If almost everyone who satisfies the anthropic principle in the landscape also has exotics, then
I didn't say that that's the case. I said that most of the constructions people have made that try to imitate the world that we see experimentally usually have the exotics. I haven't, although I mentioned anthropic earlier, that's not an ingredient in the constructions. I mean, we're already just trying to mimic what we see experimentally. And so I would say much stronger is if one found something like a 126-dimensional Higgs representation or something that's clearly non-stringy or incredibly rare in the string landscape. That would be, to me, more compelling as, or it doesn't have to be that weird, just certain types of, say, color representations that are very different from the low-lying ones that were fundamentals. That's very non-stringy.
But I should just add that the absence of exotics would only be taken as an argument against this framework if there's some argument to suggest that they should have been seen by the TEV scale. If the exotics are all at, 15 TEV, then who cares?
Well, I am really talking about TEV scale here. I mean, that was why I said quasi-chiral. If you had something that was purely vector, then usually they will acquire mass at the string scale. It's only if you have some symmetry that's broken, that protects their mass, that they'll be at a low energy. And I've been pretty much assuming that here that that the scale would be down at the electroweak scale or the TeV scale, because usually there's not obvious candidates to. You can cook up things where you get intermediate scale breaking also, but often everything's tied together, which makes it more disturbing that we haven't seen anything yet at the LHC. Of course, that same statement could be made by any phenomenologist with any beyond the standard model from any framework. So, okay, I'm essentially out of time, and I expected to get not too much further. I will simply say that I was, if I had had, well, let me just show a couple of slides. There have been, here is a list of papers of people who have sort of tried to explore some aspect of the landscape, usually just things like counting of group factors, families, et cetera, whether or not that they, in some cases not requiring that they contain the standard model, in some cases requiring that they contain the standard model but allowing bigger. I'm especially interested in the MSSM-like vacua, that is the ones that are consistent with what we know, which contain the standard model gauge group and maybe contain the MSSM supersymmetry, but may have a bigger gauge group, may have remnants. And I've been involved in a number of these studies, and I just don't have time because I don't want to go way over. I was going to mention a study I did with Miriam Svedek and Jim Halverson based on type 2A string constructions. These are ones with in which you have stacks of D brains, D6 brains, for example, which fill the three dimensions of space and then are extended objects in three of the extra six dimensions. If you've got a parallel stack of N of them, that will give a UN gauge group. Open string stuck at an intersection will give chiral matter, and a closed string will be like a graviton. And from not only these, but other types of constructions, it can be shown that sometimes the constraints, just the consistency constraints, the things that go under the name of tadpole cancellation, which is something to do with, it's like Gauss's law in the extra dimension for new charges associated with these extended objects, give you constraints on the low energy effective theory that are stronger than field theory constraints, that are stronger than just usual anomaly cancellation and constraints, etc. And in fact, these constraints do not, in a big class of models, don't allow the MSSM. One can question some of the assumptions, but large classes of these constructions don't allow the MSSM, but can be extended by extra types of matter. And we did a fairly systematic classification of these, and we found that large numbers of extensions of the MSSM were consistent with all the stringy constraints. And the types of things we found in sort of in frequency were MSSM singlets that had some sort of effective global symmetry charge. These could play the role of the singlet that solves the mu problem in the MSSM. They could play the role of right-handed neutrinos. Sometimes they do neither. Sometimes they just have random couplings. We found lots of isotriplets. These would be like an isotriplet of leptonic charges +1, 0, -1. Perfectly plausible, rarely invoked to solve any problems. Quasi-chiral pairs, extra SU2 doublets with zero color, such as lepton, you could interpret as extra lepton pairs in which both the neutral and charged component, left-handed and right-handed, were in SU2 doublets. Down-type isosinglets, as heavy charge minus a third quarks, without a top partner, left and right are both SU2 singlets. These are familiar to anybody who's ever studied E6 models, and they're invoked in phenomenology quite frequently. You can also find up quark iso singlets and quark doublet iso singlets, and you can find singlets that have unit charge. You can find funny charges, like new lepton-like doublets, but with charge plus one and plus two. You can, we even uncovered a type of shifted model. This is ruled out experimentally, but it was sort of cute. We found you could get a chiral family in which the left-handed fields were just like a family in the standard model, except the charges were shifted. So for the quark charges were minus a third and minus four-thirds, and the lepton charges were minus one and minus two. And the right-handed fields for the leptons were in a triplet, charges zero, one, and two. This is ruled out experimentally, but it was sort of cute that that emerged from this study. And as far as I know, nobody's ever written down a model like that. Often U1 primes came about. There's lots of ways to get U1 primes. They're often flavor changing and would lead to things like effects in anomalous B decays. So these were, in this particular analysis, which was really a bottom-up analysis, but motivated by top-down stringy tadpole constraints, led to those types of things being favored as a general example. Let me conclude. The string landscape and internal inflation suggest at least the possibility that some aspects of physics may be environmental. I tried to argue from the bottom up that there may be more at the TEV scale than the MSSM, and I tried to argue from the top down that there may be more at the TEV scale than the MSSM, with certain types of remnant physics perhaps favored by the framework that I'm using. And I think it's important to try to delineate as best we can the difference between serious string-inspired, and purely field-theoretic possibilities. I purposely put my conclusions here. I've got many, many more slides on the phenomenology of all these things, but I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to stop at this point. Thank you.
Well, I mean, this notion that it could be environmental, of course, is intriguing and controversial. So at the end of the day, one might think, well, we have this elaborate superstructure with a multiverse and so on, and we're just an environmental consequence. I'd like your comments on whether or not that is epistemically preferable to just saying, let's back up 30 years and just say, okay, we have an FRW universe with environmentally chosen initial conditions, and we evolve from there. There's no huge superstructure. There's none of this extra stuff we can't see. Which is preferable?
Well,
in your view, which would
in
be
my
preferable?
Personal view, the environmental multiverse point of view seems more satisfying to me.
Because
to me, it is more of an explanation. I don't have to invoke the unknown initial conditions, because in your view, you still have left open why those initial conditions.
But is that, what I'm trying to get at is I don't see how that's any different from having a larger superstructure, which at the end of the day, some other environment, initial conditions are environmental conditions.
Yes.
And if I'm going to invoke environmental conditions in a giant super landscape, why not just shrink it down and invoke them in what we know is more empirically connected? That's the thrust of the question.
Yes.
So I don't understand the epistemic gain. If anything, it's an epistemic loss, and that you have to add on a lot more epicycles, if I dare use that word. And why add them in?
Well,
I realize I'm being deliberately provocative.
I understand. Part of it is, I think if we never find any new particle physics beyond the standard model, then we will be pretty much stuck at, you know, that question. It's just a matter of preference or philosophy or whatever. However, at least I'm trying to argue that
certain types of new physics, if observed, would be at least weakly pointing in the direction I'm talking about, and certain other types of new physics would be weakly arguing against the viewpoint that I'm talking about. And I think it's better if one tries to address some of that as best we can now before we see what the new physics is, rather than waiting to that point. Yes?
Let us say that when they reach 1340 TeV with a high luminosity, 2 or 3 years, 4 years, they see nothing new. How do you think this will affect the future particle physics? Accelerators.
Well, that's, of course, a very general question. It makes, first of all, I would be very disappointed, like everybody else would, if that's the case. I think that it would be great if we could go higher. It's really too bad that the SSC wasn't built. I think 40 TeV would have been a better energy. I think it would be still worthwhile for the field to pursue the 100 TeV collider. And there are, you know, sort of talking about this both at CERN and in China. And I think that would be worthwhile. But of course, that's a very expensive, long-term, difficult goal, and we would all be a little bit disillusioned, but I think it would be worth to do that. Now, let us suppose we've seen absolutely nothing new at 13 TeV or absolutely nothing new at 100 TeV. I don't have any, you know, brilliant, magical insights that are any better than everybody else in the field about where we would go from there. I wish I did.
Any other questions? Okay, so if not, Paul is going to be here for another week and a half. He's teaching the Psi course. So feel free to watch him. But otherwise, let's thank him once again.